Recording is on.
Okay, good morning, everyone. We're ready to start the Credentials Community Group meeting. Today we have Jeff Stevens and the Dignari team. They were one of three winners of the DHS wallet design challenge that we talked about on this group a few months ago. And so they are going to be here today and share their experience, their knowledge, and their winning submission. There were three winners, so they are one of three, and they are the three winners are moving forward to the final round. Okay, the agenda that we will be following today, if you're in the IRC, it's at the top. And I will also put right here. Okay, IP note. Anyone can contribute in these calls. However, all substantive contributors to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. To do so, you need to have a W3C account and you must agree to the contributor license agreement. If you are just joining, in order to be included in the minutes, type present plus in either the IRC chat or in the Jitsi chat. These minutes and an audio recording of everything said on this call will be archived at the CCG meeting minutes URL. Putting the link in here. So we use IRC or the Jitsi chat to queue people during the meeting. If you would like to be on the queue, type Q plus sign with no space to add yourself to the queue. You can also type Q plus and then a note of what you would like to chat about or speak about. So if you are not on IRC or the internet and you're on audio only and you would like to be added to the queue, just speak up and ask yourself to be added to the queue and one of the chairs will add you. When you are making a comment and you're called on, please be brief and to the point so that we can get through the queue. And you can always queue plus again. This meeting is held by voice, not IRC, so off-topic IRC comments are subject to deletion from the record. We work hard to manage a single thread of conversation so everyone can participate and be heard. Please respect the group process by joining the queue when you have something to contribute. Okay, so next we need to select a scribe. When you scribe, you can scribe in either the IRC or in the Jitsi chat window. So let's look at the scribe list. And I know that we have some of these we haven't updated so great. So if you have, if I call on you and you've recently done it, just remind us. So is Christopher Allen here? Moses Ma. Also, if you'd like to volunteer to scribe, feel free to volunteer. Dremon Reed. Adam Lemon. Amy, looks like you have volunteered to scribe. Thank you. Okay, great. Now we have introductions and reintroductions. Do we have anyone new on the meeting that would like to introduce themselves? You can add yourself to the queue, or you can just pipe up. And make sure that if you are muted, that you unmute yourself first.
Hi there. I'm George. I work for the Government Digital Service in the UK, and I'm listening in for the first time. Hi.
Hi, George. Welcome. Are you on the IRC or just via audio?
I'm not on the IRC at the moment, but I can see the chat window in Jitsi. So.
Great.
Thanks.
Would anyone else like to introduce themselves? Okay, let's move on to reintroductions. Let's see. Do we have Marcus on? No. Is Justin? What about Chris Winzecki? I think I saw that you were on. Would you like to reintroduce yourself?
Hi, Heather. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks, Heather. So my name is Chris Winzecki, formerly with Learning Machine. Learning Machine was acquired by Highland Software out of Cleveland earlier this year. So now we're working within the Highland Software Group. I missed IIW this year, so missed most of you, but have been around in the groups for a while.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Amy, would you like to reintroduce yourself as well? I'm happy to subscribe for you. I don't know if you heard that, Amy, but would you like to reintroduce yourself as well? And I'm happy to scribe for you if you would.
She's declined in IRC.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry, I was looking for it. And I've got two different things. Okay. All right. All right. Okay, great. We will move on then. Okay, announcements and reminders. We don't really have very much going on right now, but the chairs wanted to communicate to you that we are not holding two meetings at the end of the year. The last two meetings of the year on 12/22 and 12/29 is during the holiday times, so we are not going to be having meetings during that time, and we will go ahead and start right and early at the first Tuesday that we are meeting in 2021. And we can also remind folks that there are currently three task forces that are meeting. There is the verifiable credentials for education on alternating Mondays. There's the DID resolution call on Mondays and the confidential storage calls on Thursdays. And you can have details on all of those by clicking that link. All right, let's look at progress on action items.
Hey, Heather, I queued myself for two announcements.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Wayne. Well, okay, great. Go ahead.
All right. Great. So the first one is I wanted to announce the proposal for a so-called infrastructure task force. Basically, the meeting infrastructure we're talking on now, it took quite a lot of effort, and it will continue to take some effort to maintain, you know, whether we're using Jitsi or Zoom. So basically, how can we resource this in terms of people spending time on it and also financially? to continue to make it easier to run this group so that chairs can be freed up to focus on some other things that we declared as priorities. The infrastructure task force is an attempt at an inclusive way to address this, and happy to continue discussion here or in the GitHub issues with respect to its scope. But if you're interested in helping set up the infrastructure, facilitating work items, et cetera, such as GitHub actions or maintaining the meeting infrastructure, we wanted to create a way for people to get involved. I'm happy to say there seems to be some interest financially and also people dedicating their time to it to date. So feel free to click on that GitHub issue link if you want to learn more. The next announcement that I have is that I believe it was just extended for 4 days, but there's a nomination period for the technical architecture group at the W3C. I think some folks from this group, including myself, possibly Amy, have self-nominated or might. Not sure about other folks, but I have self-nominated. Basically, I think it's important for us to have our technical concerns and understanding be influenced by and influence other parts of the W3C standards development so that everything can work really well together. I think anyone else, you know, from this ecosystem who wants to step up and self-nominate or nominate someone to the technical architecture group at the W3C, you know, that would be very useful in building that connective tissue to the rest of the other working groups at the W3C. And furthermore, other groups abroad, such as IETF, such as the OpenID Foundation, et cetera, it will put you in a position to be able to have those levels of conversation. I'm not so partial as to who within our community necessarily steps up and does the job, but I think it's just useful if someone from our ecosystem in general, you know, has their voice heard on the technical architecture group. That's all for announcements. Thank you.
Great, Wayne. You kind of, I was going to have us address the proposal of the infrastructure task force in the action items section. So we've got three items here. Do you have anything else you want to talk about for the infrastructure task force, or do we want to take any questions regarding that?
Yep, I said the piece that I needed to on that. Happy to have anyone else who replied in the thread chime in if they'd like to. Happy to field any questions, and sorry for jumping the gun a little, Heather.
Okay, so Wayne, you're off the queue right now. Okay, thanks. Okay, Manu, you're on it.
Yeah, just to speak a bit to what Wayne said about the technical architecture group, for those of you that are not familiar with what the W3C tag or technical architecture group does, they effectively set the design requirements for the entirety of the web. So, you know, what we want the web to become is partly, from an architectural perspective, the tag's job. People that are on the tag are supposed to be there as individuals first. So it's not supposed to be you're representing some company. You're supposed to be representing the people of the web, and what's best for, you know, the web and the people of the web. A very high level architectural position, it has broad ramifications around the work that W3C does. So I wanted to, you know, plus one, you know, Wayne for running and Amy for running. I think, you know, they would bring what our group does into kind of the thought process around what the future of the web looks like, which I think is a really great, great thing, to do. So, the other thing to note about these tag elections is that multiple seats open up. So we could find ourselves in a situation where both Wayne and Amy find themselves on the tag. And I think that would be, really great for, you know, this community. So all that to say, if the people that vote are actual, I believe it's the W3C membership, specifically the advisory committee that vote. So if you're an AC representative, be aware that that election's happening. I believe the timeline for that is nominations in the next couple of days, and then a voting period for about a month, with the individuals that win the election being put into place by February. That's it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Manu. Is anyone else on the queue? No. Does anyone else have any questions or comments on the infrastructure task force? I mean, I do. So my concern, and I think everyone who's already on the task force already knows my concerns, that this is a, while I appreciate all the efforts that have gone into this solution, I believe that the solution is still creates an obstacle for participation for folks that are not currently participating in this community. And so I just want to ask that the task force includes not the usual suspects to gather feedback and usage data, that it includes people that would like to participate from different geographic time zones, from different language structures, from different skill sets that are not just from a technical background, but also from design, anthropological, UX, marketing, and usability, and, you know, not just technical folks. Because I do think I would like to see, you know, the importance of having a meeting infrastructure that's accessible is an improvement in the work we do here. And to date, I still see technical obstacles being raised with our current system. Hey, Wayne, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with you there. I 100% agree that there are things that have to do with running the infrastructure of the credentials community group that require no ability to write code or even use Git. And if we're able to convert even more responsibilities towards that, towards inclusion and allowing diverse folks to participate, I think that is definitely a win. So, for example, being able to help with the notes and publishing them and even clean them up, you know, that shouldn't necessarily require anyone to enter a command line if they're not used to it. We should strive towards creating modes of engagement that don't require a technical background so that more folks, so the surface area of upholding the community can be spread over more people who are interested. And interest is really all we're hoping for. So if you're interested in contributing technical or not, I definitely invite anyone to, you know, comment in the GitHub thread or just talk in the mailing list on the thread that was started. If you're comfortable, you know, through your more comfortable with your mail client. Plus one to everything you said, Heather.
Great. Thanks, Wayne. I also wanted to alert the community to two kind of activities that are happening in the kind of chair infrastructure. We've been planning for doing some succession planning. Kim has been one of the most phenomenal chairs, putting together a lot of infrastructure for us, but she'll be moving on next year. And so we want to capture everything. Also, onboarding of new chairs. When Wayne and I came in, there was some documentation, but not a lot. So one of the things that I've personally been working on is creating a job description and instruction manual for what chairs do. This is basically like everything it requires, everything that you do as a chair, including the running minutes, or running the meetings, dealing with minutes, speakers, the work item process. A lot of those processes have been wrapped up. Kim wrapped up a lot of those processes, so we're putting the documentation together. Right now, we're at a point where the chairs are going to be reviewing this, but we will be sharing it with you guys. And I do think that having a job description will be very useful when we do have an open call for a new chair. Any questions? No. Okay, great. The other one I wanted to alert the community to is task force documentation. So there's been a lot of interest in having task forces in the CCG as kind of a sub meeting of the CCG. We've had various folks approach us to want to start task forces, and task forces have, all of our task forces to date have organically evolved out of this meeting. And so it seemed like it was appropriate to put together some more formal task force process documentation and an FAQ. So that is one of the things that I've also been working on, to define what the task force are, what the scope of the task force are, the relationship between the task force and the main meetings, the responsibilities of taking minutes and posting those, etc. So we are looking to confirm all of that, formalize all of that information. And right now, again, this is in a draft mode that the chairs will be reviewing. And once we get to a point where we'd like to share it with the broader community, we'll definitely do that. If you are interested in participating or contributing to either the job description, the activities that chairs do, or you'd like to see chairs do, or task force, what they're currently doing or would like to do, please get in touch with me, as I am driving the draft of these. Any other questions? No. Okay, great. Well then, it's time for the main event. And so I'm really excited that Jeff Stevens and the Dignari team is here today. If you joined the, DHS SVIP, wallet meeting, which was, I don't know, maybe a month ago, you might have seen some of their work and you've heard an overview of the project. But today, Jeff and his team is going to give an overview of, the work that they did. And I know I was really impressed in particular by their work because, in my mind, they really involved, the entire team and ways of thinking about things. So Jeff, are you ready to take it away?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Great. Thanks, Jeff. Okay.
Yeah. So thank you, Heather, Wayne, and Kim for allowing Dignari the opportunity to join the meeting today to kind of go over some of the stuff that we've developed as part of the UI UX challenge. Dignari, just for some background, we were formed in 2013. We're a woman-owned small business in the Washington, D.C. area. We provide a number of services to our clients, program strategy, technology delivery, emerging technology integration, data science and analytics, as well as UI UX or human-centered design capabilities. So we kind of dabble in a number of areas. We do application development. We have a long history in identity management and biometrics. So we have the technical side and we have the UI UX side as well as piece of that. So that having those capabilities kind of allowed us to kind of join forces to bring the technology and the UI UX piece together. So I'm here with a couple of my colleagues. We'll do quick introductions. I'm Jeff Stevens, the Chief Technology Officer with Dignari. Alex?
Thanks, Jeff. Hi, everyone. My name is Alex Halili. I'm a solution architect for Dignari.
And Lucine.
Hi, everyone. I'm the creative director with Dignari, focusing on UI UX.
Okay. So we won't waste a lot of time. We'll get right into it. What we're going to do is we're going to show you the screens that we came up with, the UI UX experience for a digital wallet. So Alex is going to share his screen, go through some of the use cases that were stipulated as part of the DHS UI UX challenge. And then after that, we'll field some questions and have some questions for the experts in the audience here. So Alex, I'll let you go ahead and share your screen and walk through the demo.
Sorry, I was on mute. Thank you, Jeff. Can everyone see my screen?
Yeah, we can see it.
Okay. All right. So, one of the things that we wanted to do, we weren't really sure if our video would work. I've never really used Jitsi. So we kind of decided, to actually give you guys the presentation in real time. We'll make available the video that was actually shared, with the community, the community event with the SVIP at DHS. But for today, this gives us an opportunity to kind of walk through it together with you guys, but also to kind of take some of the feedback we got from that community event and actually show you ways that we've actually updated our presentation with regard, you know, as a result of that. So as Heather alluded to, we presented this thing, I think it was at the end of October. We submitted it in mid-October for the DHS Digital Wallet Challenge. And then, this was shown at the end of October. Now what you see here, this is our branding scheme that we came up with for the digital wallet. So you can see up here in the top right, this is your color scheme, a rendering of your, desktop application over here on the left, and then a rendering of your mobile application off here to the right. Now, the assumption here is that the first thing that the individuals is going to do when they get this application is they're going to create an account. So here you provide, you know, some basic information, create a username and password. This would also be the screen where you'd present your EULA agreement and where you would actually, as part of the creation of that account, agree to that. One other thing I wanted to show too is that once that account is created, you also have the ability and you would log in with that username and password. And then obviously you can update your application to use a biometric, or any identity assurance level 2 capability. So, the last thing I want to talk about too is that, there's also potentially, you know, also a link down here that would provide you the ability to look at the disclosures as well as the privacy policies. So let's assume that, Jane, our user, is logging in with her username and password, and this is the screen that she would come to. Now on the desktop application, you'll see over here on your left side are 9 identity domains. So these are the areas where you can kind of group the verifiable credentials that you want to add to your digital wallet. And then here's a rendering of the same information off here to the right in the mobile application. So within her education part of her digital wallet, you'll see she's got her degree, a copy of her degree. And as with any of these identity domains, the same interface will occur. So you'll click on it. You'll see any credentials that are there or not there. And then there's this plus sign where you can add additional identity credentials to it. So this plus sign here off to the left in the desktop application would translate to this plus sign up here in the top right of the mobile application. Now, as we kind of looked at the digital wallet challenge and the UI UX that they were asking about, one of the keys for us was to make sure that the way you access information is consistent for the user. So whether you're accessing your legal identity or you're accessing your education information, you're doing everything the same way. And even the presentation of those verifiable credentials is presented to you in a similar fashion. Now, for the DHS Digital Wallet Challenge, we were presented with a very unique use case. So Jane is applying for a job, and as part of that application, the employer has asked for her to provide her permanent resident card and her degree from her university. So the first thing that Jane has to do now that she has a digital wallet is she has to go to the issuers and actually obtain these verifiable credentials from both her educational institution as well as USCIS. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and get her degree information from her university. And you can see here that when she selects adding an education degree to her wallet, she can provide a request form or fill out a request form that basically provides some general information that allows them to look her up. The alternative to this is if she does have a username and password, maybe she already has, you know, a login to the university, she could obviously use that. And then finally, even for, you know, further capabilities down the road, if institutions or issuers provide the capability of doing biometric verification is part of this process that can also be incorporated here. For the purposes of the demo and this, and for Jane's education request, we'll just assume she fills out this form and submits the request. Now, the assumption here is that all of the work that the CCG and W3C has done as far as the trust mechanisms that occur behind, that are in place to secure not only the communication between the holder and the issuer, but even communications with the verifier and the issuers, and all those different communications and trust mechanisms. The assumption from our perspective is that all of this occurs behind the scenes. So what you saw here was it actually connected with the institution. They did their, you know, they secured the connection as part of that. They also did the verification of her identity based on the information she provided. And then once they deemed everything as fit, then they provided the digital credential to her. And now you can see it's here ready for her to actually add to her wallet. So we'll go ahead and add it to her wallet, and you can see it's now inside of her wallet. Now, the next thing we're going to do, is the second part of her application is to provide her permanent resident card. Now, what I've done here is I've actually placed the digital a rendering of the digital version over here to the left so that you can kind of see how the mobile version and the desktop versions work and how they are consistent regardless of which version of the application you're using. So here she's got her driver's license and her passport in her digital wallet for legal identity. And now she wants to add her permanent resident card. So we'll click on add another item. And here again, you have either the ability to provide a username and password to log into USCIS, or like we did for the university request up here in the right, you can see she could potentially provide information in the way of a form as part of that request. So let's say she provided her email and her password and just logged in. So the connection again is established with USCIS. They perform all their verification and securing the connection and then provide the digital US permanent resident card to Jane, who now then will add that to her wallet. Now, again, as part of that use case, she was asked to provide both of those pieces of information. So from a user experience perspective, we really wanted to give the digital wallet interface an ability to create what we're calling packages. Now, that to the CCG and W3C is really your verifiable presentation that was discussed in the documentation. So here, Jane's going to click on packages, and we'll create a new package. And then the first thing she wants to do is she wants to add her permanent resident card. So we'll click on our permanent resident card, and we'll add that to the package. And then we'll click on another item, and we'll go ahead and add her education. Now, with regards to her education, she actually has multiple pieces of information available. She has her degree available. She also has her transcripts available. And she obtained all that when she retrieved it from the issuer. In the cases of her application, we're going to assume only thing they need is the degree. So we'll click on the degree here. And in this case, once she adds this to the package, that means that only her degree is added to the package and not her transcripts. So let's go ahead and add her degree. And you can see here now her package has the permanent resident card and her university credential or her degree. And let's click create. So at this point, this is where your package is being created. Now, one of two things can happen at this point. Assume on the left that, say, Jane is going to visit the employer maybe for an interview. And at that point, she could save off this QR code in her digital wallet and then retrieve that when she goes to see the employer for an interview and present that QR code to the employer, who can then take that, scan it, and then that will give them the information to retrieve both her permanent resident card and her digital degree. Off here to the right, there's also the alternative of when she is maybe submitting this remotely, in which case what we would do is from the mobile application, you would scan a QR code that's provided by the employer remotely, and then Jane would scan that QR code, and that would allow her to get the information she needs to send the package to them. So let's assume we're going to do that scenario and Jane is remote and she's getting ready to submit her digital package to the employer. So over here to the right, let's assume she scanned the QR code from the employer, and now she's going to click share, at which point she has to provide consent to actually release not only her permanent resident card, but her digital degree to the employer. So once she clicks yes and send, you'll see here that her job application will go from pending to sent. Now, finally, the last thing I really wanted to show was the different ways through this UI UX of managing whether it's your verifiable credential or your packages. Now, since we've been talking within the scope of packages, you see here that she's got multiple packages that she's created, right? So she actually had a package there that she created for a mortgage refinance and then another one for an application for a graduate degree. And you can also see here now the job application that she just submitted. So let's assume that she completed her mortgage refinance, everything went through, and she's done with that. So she no longer needs this package in her wallet. So she would just swipe left, and that would bring up this delete button, at which point she'll click delete. And then it'll ask her one more time to just confirm to make sure this is actually what she wants to delete. And once she clicks delete, it removes it from the list of packages. With that, I'm going to actually pass it off to Lucine, who I think is going to talk a little bit about the UI UX design. Lucine?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Thank you, Alex. In terms of the UI UX, our goal is to create the most adaptable user interface and experience design. We kept it fairly consistent between desktop and mobile. And as we go through our redesign or refinement of the screens to better align with U.S. web design standards, we are curious and would like to put this to the community as to what would provide most value to the developers during the handoff. And we're open to any questions you might have about the user experience and user interface you just experienced.
Great. Okay. Let's see. We have a queue. So Ted, would you like to go?
Yeah, I just wanted to note that, looking at those interaction windows, the first thing was the login, which on the desktop app asked for email address and on the, phone app asked for a username. Blurring those two is or will be troublesome. I've run into this in a number of different places, and it's getting worse, particularly with something like a digital wallet where you're trying to combine your identities from various places. Like you just had a login for a university that is going to have its own username or email address that you use to get your details from them. And I'm presuming that all of this is being stored somewhere at Dignari or in the cloud because it's going to be on all of my devices, except maybe I don't want it on all of my devices, or maybe I don't want everything on all of my devices, or maybe I don't want it in the cloud. I just want it on my device. I'm just seeing a lot of scary stuff in what's there.
Yeah. And some of that, the architecture and where data is stored and all that will be handled most likely by digital wallet providers. Those are issues they're going to have to work through for sure from the privacy standpoint and accessibility standpoint. From our view and what the challenge was just for the UI UX piece of it. So all the underlying wiring of those systems and security and all that stuff is not necessarily what we designed to. It was more of from a user, how do I interact with this system? How do I use the credential? What's intuitive to me? With the understanding that absolutely, as you said, Ted, that there's going to be significant challenges for the solution providers that are actually building the digital wallet itself.
I see. So this is basically a dummy mock-up of UI UX with no connection whatsoever to the technologies behind it.
That's correct.
Yeah, Ted.
Okay.
Thank you, Ted, for that comment. We will definitely, at least from a UI UX perspective, definitely want to make sure that we're consistent That was just a slight oversight on our part, but you're right. We have to make sure that the callouts that we provide, whether it's the desktop or the mobile application, are definitely consistent. But you bring up a really interesting point, which is the challenge of, you know, these connections to various, whether it's an issuer or a verifier. Anytime we're connecting with an external entity, you know, from a UI UX perspective, you know, our goal is to make that experience consistent regardless of how you're connecting and what information you're providing. And that's the challenge. You're absolutely right that definitely certain issuers require maybe a username. Other issuers require an email. You know, I think for us to work with the CCG to maybe try to figure out how we can make that easier, you know, that I think would be how we as US UI UX designers could provide some help there to try to bridge that and really make it easier for the user experience.
Yeah, and I think the intent, or one of the main intents of the DHS challenge, was to kind of get in front of the process a bit and start doing some of the design from a user standpoint, even while the technology is being baked behind the scenes, so that I guess they can gain adoption or gain interest from the larger community on adopting digital wallet concepts. So I think the UI UX pieces they're looking for, at least from what I've kind of understood from Anil Jain and the group that's running it, is they want the UI UX design to serve as a like bootstrap design package for people that want to build digital wallets.
All right. Yeah. The fact that this was a DHS challenge also puts a different spin on it too, because they want to unify all of my identities. They want to know me wherever I am. While I don't want the DHS to know that I'm in the Rebel Alliance, but maybe I want to have that member card in my wallet so that I can go to the clubhouse.
Yep. Or the cantina.
Indeed. Yeah.
So, yeah. And I think DHS's position, and I obviously can't speak for DHS, but I think their position has always been that they don't want to be the digital wallet provider or any sort of authority over it. They're just trying to serve as the accelerator for the community, I think.
Okay, great. We have other folks on the queue, and you know, Anil Jain and no one from DHS SVIP is here, but I think that he would take umbrage with some of your comments, Ted, and I will just leave it at that. I don't think that your comment about that is necessarily fully reflective of the nuances of Anil's and the SVIP's motivation in supporting the work in this space. Okay, so next on the queue, Manu, you're up.
Yeah, so first off, thank you for the presentation. You know, fantastic work. Loved seeing, you know, the UI mockups. One of the things that jumped out at me was the interaction between the wallet and the issuer. It is, you know, there are kind of two interaction paradigms that are in play. There's kind of the, you know, the sovereign indie interaction paradigm, which I think is what was mocked up. And then there's also the credential handler web browser based interaction paradigm. And they're very different. So the first question is, had you, you know, made a decision to use one or the other, like one path versus the other? And if you were not aware that there was this other interaction paradigm, maybe one of the things that, you know, we could talk about, you know, next time is, how that interaction paradigm is different. Like to give you an example, the UIs that you have this concept of the individual creating the packages, whereas the other interaction paradigm actually has the entity requesting, a set of credentials from you, right? So you don't need to know what to put together. They will ask you for a set of things, and then you decide whether or not you want to share those things. So it's a very different UX paradigm. So just wondering where you are in that thought process of these different paradigms and making sure that we're taking all of them into account.
No, that's awesome feedback. And those are exactly the types of things we want to get clarity on, because we are not necessarily experts in this field. So getting these nuanced pieces of the technology from the community is really valuable. I guess my perspective on that is that I didn't know the two interactions necessarily, but I see what you're saying, where it can be driven by the end user, the holder of the wallet, or the requesting entity, being the two types of interactions. I guess from what we did, it's from the perspective of an individual because it's a digital wallet. So it's I guess inherent that the person would own this thing. It would be their wallet in a way, where the entity, and correct me if I'm wrong, would the entity have a similar concept of a digital wallet from an entity? Cause I may interact with a number of people. Would I have the same thing from an entity standpoint?
Yes and no. There are use cases where you might, but that I think that's kind of a sideline thing, right? The main thing I was wondering is that there are a set of DHS videos showing kind of a testing of all these digital wallets, and I'm guessing you hadn't seen it yet, but that video is really good to look at because it flips the paradigm. It shows you the other paradigm, right? So I get that what you did was individual centric. There's the other paradigm is kind of organization centric, and both of them are totally legitimate. But you know, if we're going to do a good job as a community, we need to understand kind of both paradigms and where you use one over the other.
Yeah, Maya, thank you so much for that comment. I think you know, I personally did not see the other videos. I didn't realize that, you know, where they were, or even had the opportunity to see it. Now, I think from our perspective, you know, we kind of went with the concept of providing the optimal control for the holder. So I think we kind of took the digital wallet and the holder of the digital wallet perspective here. But I think what we're learning is that even from a UI UX, maybe we have to provide the capability or guidance as part of that UI UX to support not only the holder creating that package, but also maybe the issuer or the verifiers having that ability. So, you know, obviously from a UI UX perspective, we can create designs that support both of them.
Great. Yes. And I just put a comment in there. I think that, this could be an opportunity for us in the community to have clear, explicit use cases that document not just the individual, but both the legal entity and also potential IoT identity. Okay, who do we have on the queue? I think, Adrian, you're up next.
So, hi. Thank you very much for the for tackling this these things that for example, Manu just raised, and the fact that your demonstration, your mock-up is so thorough in addressing the different components actually then moves us to the point that that Manu made. I also have struggled with trying to build wireframes, certainly nothing designed around what goes on from the subject's perspective, from the patient's perspective in my case. And one of the questions I have for you in seeing your demo is I expect that people will not be familiar with this duality that Manu has mentioned. So specifically, they will not understand when the QR codes are used other than the way they use them in an airline boarding situation. They using the QR codes in any other way is going to have to be presumably explained, I think. And this is a question for you as to how we deal with, or how you would deal with, this duality between sometimes the QR codes are a request and sometimes they're a presentation. And again, this overlaps exactly with what the point Manu was just making. And then the related point has to do with the form that you showed, which is, again, very good that you put it in there because it shows the reality of the situation. And in that case, the user needs to be clear as to whether the information on the form is going directly to the issuer or the verifier. In other words, you know, in the OAuth sense, you kind of know when you look at the top whether who you're talking to, what domain you're entering the information to, and again, whether you had this problem or whether you understand this issue as a privacy issue when it comes to introducing these forms into the app. And so those are sort of my two questions slash points.
That's great. Yeah, it's true that, you know, a lot of these concepts are new and very strange to your common user. So yeah, I think more instruction would perhaps need to be put into the UI to provide some of that guidance on what they're looking at, what they're supposed to do next, or what the ramifications of what they're doing next means. So yeah, I agree with what you're saying.
Okay, next up on the queue is Phil.
Oh, thank you. it's been a great presentation, and it's exactly, I think, what Adrian just said about seeing the wireframes that allows us to ask better questions. Two things. I think the man who was really, I think, getting at the question of the ability to use selective disclosures in the revealing of information so that you can create a presentation that is containing only the things in it that you want disclosed to the recipient. And so I was sort of expecting to see mechanisms in the UI to take that relatively complex activity of what a selective disclosure proof is and make it easy for the individual to pick the elements that they would like to be able to convey and not the others. So I didn't see that. So I just wanted to emphasize that seems an important dimension. The second is that the data models that we have to choose from, there was no reference to the different sorts of packages that these credentials are being conveyed in, a CLR versus an OBI V2 data model, et cetera. And these things are useful because they have richer ability to convey information about what the person has learned and can do, which is a tremendous benefit other than I got a degree or I didn't. And so one of the benefits I think that we're hoping to get out of this is the ability to enable the individual to have that expressive ability to describe elements of their documented assertion. And so I didn't see any reference into the, I got a degree. I just saw the image of a diploma, which may or may not actually be there in one of these models. And was curious to know whether that was in a second phase of consideration or whether that just wasn't the choice of the particular data model package that the different VCs may have wasn't anywhere referenced in the choice of what I had as a user to create a presentation with.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Phil. From the selective disclosure standpoint, we tried to show that with the degree selection that Alex went through, where you had the opportunity to select just the degree or to add in the transcript. So it's, he got the degree from the issuer, he got the information from the issuer, but then when he was disclosing it, he did have the opportunity to select which part or how much of that data to release. So that was our interpretation of selective disclosure. So I don't know if that's enough or we need some more there.
Well, the data models are typically much richer than that.
Sure.
Including the ability to show evidence of work, for example, in a link to an IPFS file or something like that. So I get if what you're saying is that was sort of a hint at the first level of that, and yeah, you could additional UI work could expand that in some way, then that makes sense.
I got you. So you're saying, so if we get a degree, there's a set within whatever defined data model that is, there's a set of attributes that would be listed that you could select from.
Right. Okay. That's correct.
Yeah, Phil, thank you for that. I think that we have seen cases where down to the attribute level, giving the holder control to actually control down to that level. I think part of the assumption here is also from the user's perspective, the challenge becomes, you know, what can you present to the user that actually makes sense to them? Although you actually saw a picture of the diploma, that doesn't necessarily mean that the information that's sent is actually a picture. You know, that QR code can represent, you know, connection information that allows the verifier to actually go to the issuer and actually retrieve that specific diploma and the related information to that. You know, I think it's definitely a delicate balance with what we, you know, show to a user, because I think sometimes if you show a user a ton of information, a ton of checkboxes, and, you know, have to ask them what to check and what to select, what to unselect, then it becomes challenging for the user to understand, well, what am I really doing here? But still very much an important part. And this is where we would love to get the input from the CCG on, you know, what kind of things do we have to present to the user with regards to selective disclosure? You know, do we have to get down to the attribute level? And if so, then, you know, maybe we have to create a design for that.
Great, thanks. This is a great discussion, and we've got a very vibrant queue and only 3 minutes left. I just wanted to make a comment. I was so impressed by this work and the way you put it into the user perspective. And it kind of hit me. It really reminded me of some work that some of us in this community worked on with SWIFT, the European Banking Consortium, about 8 years ago. And that was called the Digital Asset Grid. And one of the main concepts of that back then was that users have data all over the web. And even though it's data about ourselves, it's not necessarily stuff that we control. And so the digital asset grid was this concept of like basically like a wallet where you could go out and make connections to all your data. But then, you know, your wallet was like your little control panel. And then from there, you could choose how you want to share the data that is about yourself. And so it was really interesting. I'd kind of forgotten about this project, but when I saw you presenting, I was like, oh my God, here it is. Here's the UI. Here's the concept. And all of us in this community are working on that technology. So I just wanted to mention that. And we've got a couple more minutes left. Wayne, you're on. If you can keep it short and sweet, that'd be great.
Yep, I'm going to keep it short. So I just wanted to highlight two standardization or work item opportunities that I see, you know, directly related to this work and work that other folks have been doing on wallets. The first one is standardizing how we use out-of-band communication, such as through QR codes, which can only hold around 3 kilobytes, right? What's the standard way that we should include connection information? What are the different moves that all wallets should support? Because if we believe wallets should be open and interoperable, this piece is pretty important. I know there's has been some work in the Aries community with respect to out-of-band work and some interoperability there. It could be a great place to start, but I also see it as a great potential work item. The second point that I think could also make a really good work item for the community is being able to take a page out of the accessibility guidelines from the W3C, which have been very successful, adopted by governments worldwide in terms of how do you have accessible access to the web. And can we tailor that or some notions of that to different ways of users working with credentials so that we can have those accessibility criteria specific to the standards and technologies we're working with. I think just having some guidelines like that could help a lot to create the standard experience, allowing more interoperability for users to have choice. That's it. Thanks.
Great. And Nate, I'm going to let you also make a comment. And then if the Dignari team wants to respond. And Ted, sorry, we're going to have to punt on you for today.
Cool, thanks. I'll be brief. And I think Alex might have spoken to this briefly as well. When we talk about selective disclosure, we should make sure that we don't confuse the two concepts of selective disclosure at the claim level within a single credential versus allowing a user to select which credentials go into a presentation. UX for those two different concepts might be different.
Okay, great. Any final words by Dignari team?
No, just again, thank you for the really great questions. I mean, it's absolutely what we needed. So we appreciate it. What we would like to do, Heather and Wayne and Kim, if it's okay, we'll send you a link to the YouTube video so that people can go visit it and take a look at it later offline. And then we'll probably send the presentation over and maybe some questions and just let the community kind of tear at it, offline outside the meeting if that works.
Yeah, that's great. If you're a member of our mailing list or even if you're not, if you send it to us, we can have a discussion on the mailing list. And so I'd like to say thank you, Jeff, Lucine, and Alex for coming and presenting your amazing solution, your wallet solution. I also want to say thank you to Amy for scribing today. This will conclude our CCG meeting for today. And thank you. We'll be back next week. And I think we've got another great speaker next week. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you.